We're going to call the meeting to order. It's 8:15. Call the Education Finance Committee to order, and we do have a quorum. And so I would entertain a motion to approve of the January 16th minutes of the Education Finance Committee. Do I hear anyone care to venture a motion for that? Representative Hertaus moves to approve the January 16th minutes of the Education Finance Committee. Any discussion on that? If not, I will call for the vote on the approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Today, we are going to start to hear an overview from Mr. Strom and Ms. Johnson. And I think Ms. Johnson's going to start out in talking and looking at a spreadsheet. Next Tuesday, the governor will present his budget. On Wednesday, right here in this room, we will have a joint meeting with the Senate Education Finance Committee to go over the governor's proposals. We will always be putting things in terms of what you will see in this spreadsheet today to keep everything consistent and hopefully try to make it a little simpler, even though it's a very complex, lots of line items there. And so what I'd like to do in contrast to yesterday is that if you do have a question during the presentation, feel free to ask questions. So that way we can keep right up there. So. All right. With that, Ms. Johnson, please proceed. And I think we're going to,
Mr. Chair, we hope to put things up on the screen here. For some reason, my computer is giving me a little bit of the business,
okay.
So it should
very
pop
good.
Up on the screen in a moment.
We'll go as far as we can. On the handouts, it got a little too small, so I think we're going to try to put it up there if we can. But at any rate, I think we can do the first part. So, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before I jump into the spreadsheets, I wanted to give you a general roadmap for what Tim and I are going to be discussing today, which we hope to cover. I'm going to start out by discussing the two primary tracking spreadsheets that the chair mentioned that will be following you throughout the budget process as you put together the omnibus E12 funding bill for the next 2 years. The first one is the appropriation tracking sheet, and the second is the property tax levy tracking sheet. Next, Tim and I are going to go over a general overview of K-12 and its context within the overall state budget. And then Tim is going to walk you through some general education funding printouts. This gives you some district-by-district information and some different options for displaying the information, and then talk about an overview of the components that make up the general education revenue. And finally, in a nod to some members, Representative Brainerd and others who have requested information that kind of breaks down the data by more specific demographic and other indicators like ethnicity and free and reduced lunch indicators. We'll get into a couple of examples of that for your information. So I'm going to start out with the appropriation tracking spreadsheet. You'll see it's titled 2003 Session Appropriation Tracking. These numbers have been...
And Ms. Johnson, why don't we hold that up just to make sure everyone's at a good starting point. So it's on just the 8.5 by 11 one, not the 8.5 by 14. So everyone there? All right.
Thank you. So all of these numbers have been updated to reflect the most recent estimates by MMB and MDE for the forecast revenues for our committee. And as you look across the page, you'll see that the columns orientate you to the various fiscal years that we're going to be addressing. The first set of columns is fiscals 12 and 13. That's the current biennium that we're in. Those monies have been appropriated, but it's helpful to give a context for what the current spending levels are and what we're looking at moving forward. The next set of columns is the base, and that's for 14 and 15. That's the decision points that you'll be making during this process, and the base is determined by two processes. The first, if it's by law, if there's a formula, if it's formula driven, and a large chunk of K-12 funding is in fact formula driven. So to the extent that enrollment is going up, the revenues that are projected to be spent for that will also be increasing. If it's not formula driven, with other aspects of the state budget, the spending level carries forward from the previous fiscal year, so that's how that works. And then the final set of columns is for fiscal 16 and 17, And these are what we've referred to as the tails. They're for, here for planning purposes, but to the extent that you make decisions in this current budget cycle, they can have impact on the future years, and we want to be able to track how that would have an impact going forward. So, and as the chair said, next week I'll be adding a column for the governor's recommendations, and then compare that. There'll be a column after the 14-15 that the governor is recommending, and then a column that compares the governor's recommendation to the base, the House committee, and then as we go along, I'll add columns. So you'll be getting a legal size in the future. It'll keep getting longer and longer and longer. So that's the basic framework for how it's laid out column-wise. In terms of the rows, the general framework for the way the spreadsheet is set up is how the omnibus education bill has typically been put together by articles. So, for example, the first section, the general education program, it tends to be Article 1. And it, the numbers here are quite substantial, and you'll, as I'd like to point out, about 80% of the overall budget that you'll be contemplating is contained in, within this area, and so there's really strong emphasis, and that's why Tim's going to be talking more about the specific components that drive that. Some of the components are compensatory, small schools, sparsity, equity, QComp, referendum, equalization aid. So we'll get into that a little bit further. The next grouping is education excellence. That is typically Article 2. That includes things like charter school, lease aid, literacy incentive aid, statewide testing. This tends to be a catch-all or a conglomeration of programs that don't have a good place otherwise. So that's kind of where that is located. If you look at the next page at line 54, you'll see special programs. That is the other primary driver of the funding, or the biggest component, the second biggest component. And this is special education. And specifically, special education, unlike other programs, has the revenue that is allocated or appropriated for special education is capped, but there is a 4.6% inflator or inflation factor that's built into that that carries forward over time. The next set of categories is facilities and technology for capital needs of the districts. There are levy and aid components to that, and I'll get into the levy components on the next spreadsheet. The next set is nutrition. A lot of that is federal dollars, but the state does have a role to play in nutrition. The next set is libraries. The Department actually manages the statewide library system, and so that's why they're included in your committee jurisdiction. If you turn to page 3, we get into family and early childhood programs, and these include ECFE, Head Start, community education, adult basic education. The reason they're in this section, or they're carved out in this area, is that in the past, sometimes this section has been seen as a separate budget committee within the House, and so it's kind of put there so it can be taken in or left in based on the decision making of the leadership. And then if you turn to the next page, page 4, you have three state agencies that the committee has jurisdiction over: the Department of Education, which is logical, also the Minnesota State Academies for the Deaf and Blind, which is located in Faribault, and the Purpich Center for Arts Education, which is located in Golden Valley. As you can see, about $74 million for those total operations. And then finally, on page 5, you'll see on line 185, this is the summary education finance general fund appropriations. If you look at 12 and 13, it looks like there's a big jump there in for fiscal 13. But again, this includes the forecast payback of the shift, and so that's reflected in that higher number. So that's why the year-over-year number looks quite significant. But if you flow down to the bottom on line 203, you'll see that we pull that piece out to give you a better indication of how education expenditures are moving over time. Are there any questions on this particular spreadsheet? I don't know if you want more detail or less. Yes.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question back on page 4. Which line was the Purpose Center for the Arts?
That is 162. I didn't put Purpose in front of it. It's the Center for Arts Education.
I thought so. Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, on page 1, line 24, where you have a change item and it's italicized, would you care to talk about what that will mean in the future?
Yes. I should have mentioned that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, the line 24, when we contemplate different decision points in the budget, I will always be indicating these changes as in italics, and so you'll be able to see which ones are the ones that we're contemplating as part of the budget process.
Okay. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question regarding the basic formula amount. If I were to take that amount and divide it into the general education subtotal, is it fair to assume then that that's the total number of students in K-12 in the state?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Johnson.
And Representative, that number is actually a summary. There's a separate spreadsheet that ties into that, and that is one component of it, but the other components are compensatory and equity and other aspects, and Tim will get into the specifics of that, but that is just a summary number there. So it's about, I think for the entitlement purposes, it's about $5 billion for that line item. So the per pupil, based on, I believe there's 827,000 students, that would total out to that number. So.
Representative Hertaus, did that answer your question? I thought you asked something else.
Oh. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to get a handle on how many Minnesota students we have.
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, as Ms. Johnson said, we've got about 850,000 pupils thereabouts as our unweighted count. But when we weight the students, which is what we use for the funding formula, we've got close to 1 million. We've got about 965,000 or thereabouts. And so one nice rule of thumb we've got is that every dollar on the formula allowance costs us about $1 million. So if you're thinking about a formula allowance of $5,224 per pupil, that's about $5.2 billion. So it's a real nice rule of thumb that we can use in this committee that every dollar on the formula is about $1 million. And as Ms. Johnson said, on line 10 of the spreadsheet there, we're adding that basic formula amount, which shows up on line 5, plus these other factors of general education. And we'll get into those other factors. But really, a very helpful rule of thumb for you is to think of about 1 million funding pupil units when you're thinking about program changes.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the next spreadsheet I'm going to talk about is the property tax levy tracking spreadsheet, and that's the longer legal-sized one. So for purposes of this committee, we're going to be tracking the property tax impact of the proposed budget option that you're considering to the extent that they impact the local property tax levy, specifically the school taxes. So, for example, if you were to contemplate changes in the health and safety program to open it up to more funding possibilities or increase the scope of that program, there is a levy component and an aid component, and so we would track the levy component in this spreadsheet to see how would it impact the overall projected school levies. As you can see, similarly to the appropriations tracking spreadsheet, the columns are weighted out by fiscal year, and I gave you for the purposes of today, I wanted to give you a broader historical context going back to 2002 to see how those levies have changed over time. And then typically going forward, I'll focus on the current biennium, the budget planning years, and then the tails. So that will be kind of what we'll focus on. And I wanted to highlight, too, if you look at the second to last set of numbers, therefore it says fiscal 2014 at the top, pay 13, that those numbers have recently been certified by the school districts. So any changes that you make or any decisions that you make this year won't have any impact on the pay 13 fiscal 14 impacts, but it would have impacts going forward from pay 14 and forward. So In a similar way, the spreadsheet is organized by fund, and the general education fund makes up about 60% of overall school levies. The next major component is debt service at about 35%, and then there's smaller categories, including community service, that is the smaller portion of that. So, as you can see, each line represents a levy category. And so for general fund, you can see there's equity, operating capital, referendum, safe schools, health and safety. So those are some of the bigger pieces of the general ed levy. And you're all well aware that we keep a close tab on the levy. Do you have a question, Mr. Chair?
No. Representative Van Zelk, I think, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At some point here, probably sooner rather than later, I think it would be instructive if the committee got some information, at least a one-pager, on a snapshot of the Safe Schools levy. What districts are levying, what that looks like, and what districts are applying Safe School levy dollars to.
Mr. Straub.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ansells, two things for you. In the guidebooks that you've got in your folders, there's going to be explanations
of
these
programs.
I knew
you were going to talk about a guidebook.
and those will often have a six-year funding history and a description of how the money is calculated and that kind of thing. Okay. So in both of your guidebooks, you'll find almost all the programs listed. And then the second thing, Mr. Chair, is the budget narrative that accompanies the governor's budget that comes out next week is a very good document that often tells about usage and things. So it's not so much a summary of his new proposals as it is describing exactly the questions you're asking. What kinds of activities are taking place with that levy, how many districts are levying it, that kind of thing. So between the guidebooks and the budget narrative, those are the two real good places to look for that kind of information.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a general question. You know, having been on the school board, one of the things I observed is the money that we get, okay, the new money or whatever, tends to go for salary and benefits and programs, okay? And what happens is we don't have enough money as a school board in many cases to keep the facilities updated, our facilities updated and in good repair. So what happens is, as the buildings began to need that, I know there's we do a healthy health and safety levy, which you have to go to the state to get approval to do certain updates. So then you levy that. But the way the system works, you have very little money to keep just in the normal course of funding to keep your facilities up, and then all of a sudden you go to the public and say, We need an operating levy referendum because the buildings are falling apart, and the money's all spent on every other area, which I understand that. But is there any money in these spreadsheets that is actually designated for keeping facilities up and is protected from being used in other areas? I know in the past, many years ago, they had a capital improvement fund, but my observation is a lot of that's been eroded over time, and the money now can transfer all over the place. So is there any money that's specifically sent to the districts on a regular basis without additional levy that can actually be used for the upkeep of the facilities?
And I know down the road we're going to be talking a lot about these different funds and so forth, but Mr. Straub, if you could answer this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, there's about $200 per pupil called operating capital money. And under normal circumstances, that money is reserved. That's kept in a separate reserve account, and that's to be spent on small building upkeep matters, technology, and that kind of things. However, for the last 4 years, the legislature has passed a provision that allows school districts to transfer money from that reserve into their general operating account. So that'll be a decision this legislature will have to look at again, whether it wants to continue that or not. But that's about $200 per pupil per year that's in that account. That's one of the biggest struggles that this committee faces, is whether to reserve money for specific purposes or have local school boards make those decisions.
And just one follow-up comment.
Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just urge all of us to think that through carefully, because my observation over a 16-year period of time is it's so easy to spend that money in other areas and not keep safe and updated buildings. So I think because of the way the situation is structured, I think having a separate fund that's protected from being used from other things, at least on a minimal basis, to protect the to do upkeep and health and safety on the buildings is prudent and wise, and it protects our property taxpayers from having this extra health and safety levy, subject to approval of the state, put onto their property taxes. Just food for thought. Okay.
Very good. Representative Breiner, is this a question for technical or is it a response to Representative Gruenhagen? I guess I want to stick to what we're doing here today. We're going to have plenty of time to debate issues. So let's,
Mr. Chair,
is that all right, Representative Breiner? I mean, I don't want to get into a debate here. I just want to go through the spreadsheets and go over the technical things. And Representative Gruenhagen, I appreciate that. I think we're going to have lots of time to talk about, you know, what we do with these funds and that type of thing. But I want to try to avoid that today if we can. So, Ms. Johnson, if you could continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, like I was saying, the levies are limited, and we keep close tabs on the amount that local schools are able to levy by law, with two very significant exceptions where there's local discretion, where the school district can go to the voters and ask for additional funds through an election. And the primary there's two primary ones, and they are the levy referendums, which you'll see on line 17 of the spreadsheet, and you can see how those amounts have changed over time. And it's a significant portion of the overall general fund. I calculate it's about 55% of the overall general fund levy portion. So it's a significant amount, and it's grown over time. If you take a look at the...
Ms. Johnson, what line was that you were referring to just
17.
Now? Okay. Thank you.
There's also a... Mr. Chair, there's also a... an aid component to that as well, but this is the portion that's levied by the schools. On the second page, you'll see there's the debt service fund, and this is on line 108. That's where the voter-approved debt bond issues or levy referendums for school construction or remodeling take place. And there's on line 109, you'll see that there's debt equalization there as an offset to just give you a sense of how much aid is flowing to that program as well.
So let's just stop just for a second here. That's a great point. So 108, line 108, if we're going to go over to what's occurring right now in pay 2013, so it'd be fiscal year 2014, pay 2013, the basic debt levy, $703 million. And then the debt equalization is the aid at $22 million. So that would... Of course, that's being put on here. It's not a levy, but it's the aid portion of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's good. I appreciate how you've tracked that, because one of the things you see is how that the levy's gone up while the equalization's gone down in many cases here, especially with the referendum and the debt service. So. Okay. Oh, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And where do we see then the aid component to the referendum?
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, the referendum, unfortunately, on this sheet, you'll only see the levy component. We'll have a separate spreadsheet we can pass out to you that shows the referendum aid and levy. But the reason that we track this as a deduction is because for the debt service and not for the operating referendum is that the debt service amount essentially is a fixed amount that the district needs to pay its bonds, and then the levy, the equalization aid reduces that so that the full amount essentially shows up. So it's just sort of a differential in the way we do our tracking. So on this spreadsheet, you don't ever see the aid portion of the referendum, nor do you see the aid portion of the other equalized levies on here. It's only the case with the debt where we show the equalization, and that's because essentially that levy debt first is an important number for purposes of repaying their bonds.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, The debt service fund accounts for about 35% of the overall property tax levies. Just wanted to point that out. And then on the last page, you'll see line 181 gives the total revenues. Then we take for the total revenue levies, and then we take off any offsetting credits and get to the total certified levy at line 199. So you can see how those levies have changed over time. It's important to note that the tax committee is going to be interested in the budget decisions or the budget options that you're contemplating to the extent that they impact the overall positive or negative impact, the overall property tax levies directed at school. So we'll be tracking that. The tax committee will be tracking that, and so we'll just, it's just for your information.
And Representative Chair Daphne will be keeping very close tabs on what we do here. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the grand total levies, I noticed looking at the last five bienniums, this fiscal year 2012-2013.
Representative Quam, what number line are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. That I'm looking really at 188 through 190,
okay.
That section.
Okay.
And it appears, I'm trying to understand this 2012-2013 biennium is much lower than any of the four preceding bienniums, for percent of grand total levies, dramatically lower. So does that mean that there's less property taxes? The increase is, there's a much smaller property tax increase than there has been for, the recent history.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. Strom.
That's a very good question. One thing to keep in mind with school levies, and the way Ms. Johnson's laid the spreadsheet out, if you go all the way back to pay 2001, the very first column on there, and look at line 181, you'll see that the gross school levy number in that year was about $2.4 billion. And the next year was the year of the one-third, one-third, one-third compromise at the legislature between the House, Senate, and Governor Ventura. And part of that was to remove about $1 billion of school property tax levy. So your comment is exactly right, but two things to keep in mind with that. When the base got lowered, the same dollar amount of increase each year is a much bigger percentage increase. A $20 million or $50 million levy increase on a $1 billion base is quite different than on a $2 billion base. So you could have the same levy increase but have a smaller percentage increase each year out we get because the base gets larger. So that drop between fiscals 2002 and 2003 meant that for the years, if you look at the very bottom line, percent change from previous year, you'll see those first couple of years there was a really big change, and then as you scroll across there, you'll see those percentage changes. Let's see if I can get that to scroll across for us. Gets smaller, but your point is exactly right that the last biennium the percent changes were very small on the school levies.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's why I said that looking at the last five, I excluded.
Mm-hmm.
But it. It's nice to see that there's we aren't having an annual percent increase like that. And I was wondering, was that relational to the fact that on the previous, there was, taking out the shift, there was about a 9% increase so that districts didn't see that they needed to go to the taxpayers for as much?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I think a couple things are going on there. Certainly the biggest factor is the number of referendums that pass each year to affect the school levies. So if you look up at that line 17 for the operating referendum line and then at the debt service line, you'll see that the bigger percent increases at the very bottom tend to be related to the years when there was a lot of referendum passed. And your second part of that question, whether the passage of the referendum is related to what we do here and the level of school funding we provide here, that's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. We know that the operating referendums tend to vary on average when they're held in an even-numbered election year with a general election. There's less of them that pass. But whether or not extra money on the formula or not affects the level of referendum passage isn't very clear to me. But you can certainly see that you can look across at the categories that change here on the spreadsheet, and you'll see that generally in the years with the biggest increases, there'll be big referendum increases in those years.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Mark Wirt. I just wanted Ms. Johnson to explain line 110 under debt service fund so members understand the maximum effort, and then also to explain under 138 the OPEB, the OBED levies.
Ms. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer to my colleague.
Okay, Mr. Straub?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, on the maximum effort program, what that program is where the state sells bonds, general obligation bonds of the state, to help school districts with relatively low tax bases and large building needs build new buildings. And what happens is the reason the program's named the maximum effort program is the school district's then required to levy a maximum tax rate set in statute to repay those loans. And if the loan isn't repaid over the term of the loan, and they either ran 30 or 50 years, most of the ones that are out there now are running 50 years, most of the previous ones ran 30 years, at the end of that time, whatever's not repaid to the state, including any accumulated interest, is essentially forgiven. And so what we carry on this line, this 110, is the additional levy that a district makes for its maximum effort purposes, separate and above from what happens with the debt equalization program. So it's sort of the debt equalization lowers their tax rate, and then we boost them back up. So that's not necessarily the repayment amount for the debt equalization, but that's the amount that the levy comes back up after they've gotten the debt equalization. So, for an example, the Red Lake School District is a district that has an outstanding maximum effort loan. There's very little tax base in the Red Lake area. The district levies the required amount by statute, the required repayment rate, and pays its local share of bonds with that. And if there's anything left after it pays its local share, it sends that amount into the state. For most of the districts still in the maximum effort program, they're not paying the loans off. Their interest is accumulating over time, and at the end of the term of their loan, their principal as well as their interest will be forgiven. The second category you asked about is called OPEB, and there's two types of OPEB levies. And OPEB, the debt levy shows up starting on line 138. That stands for other post-employment benefits. And in Minnesota, what these other post-employment benefits are retired health insurance benefits for school employees. A large number of districts at one time or another included in their contracts provisions to pay retirement health insurance costs. What happened was in the 2008 legislative session, authority was granted for school boards to bond for these costs, and that's what shows up on lines 138 to 146 is the amount that's levied in the debt fund. The districts, we've got a separate printout on this that we'd be happy to share with you. The districts that bonded for it essentially put that money in an account, and then each year are defraying their retiree health benefits costs with that. You can see that started, as you come across the spreadsheet there, that started at $26 million, and the bonded amount's up to about $69 million now, and is likely to stay at that amount because the change in the 2009 said you couldn't do bonding without voter approval. So the districts that bonded were those that did it between 2008 and 2009. And then if you go back up on Ms. Johnson's spreadsheet to line, let's see here, please. There we go, on line 66, the annual OPEB levy. Other districts, as well as the now, are allowed to levy for their previous year's retired employee health costs, as long as those provisions are now out of their contract for future, essentially for future employees. So if a district has taken a provision out of its contract so they no longer will pay a retiree health benefit for future employees, they can levy for their past the year's costs in the past years, and you can see that that's estimated to grow at a somewhat quick rate. That's for the current years, the current biennium. You can see where we're at there, and we're expecting that to grow by the end of the amount shown here up to about $39 million. We're happy on any of these levy items. We're happy to give you more information on a printout. So, for example, if the committee wanted to see OPEB details, we can just simply put out a printout on that. And often, Mr. Chair, if it's just something for general information, the way this committee has worked in the past, a member will ask for a printout like that. Ms. Johnson and I will just print that out, and it'll be in the folders for the next week. Not necessarily something to talk about, but just so that members can see the details about that.
Very good. Representative Radinovich.
So, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
So then, yes, I would request for the committee that printout and also the maximum effort, so we all understand those both. Thank you.
You're okay?
Yeah, I had my question answered, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Hertoff.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. My question has to do to come back to the school district revenue levies. For those of us who haven't served on education finance before, could you just comment what is the historical significance that we at the state level should care what the local school district is levying, and why is that on this spreadsheet?
Mr. Straub.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a very good question. I think there's a couple reasons for it. One, the legislature finds itself in the business of managing the overall level of property taxes, whether that's city and county or school district. And Representative Marquardt and others that have served on the tax committee can tell you all the time and energy that committee puts into essentially trying to hold property taxes down. The state has a very large system of property tax aids and credits. About 8% of the total state budget goes right back, not including the education share, goes right back out the door to local units of government in an effort to keep property taxes low. So a large part of the reason we track every change and account for every change on a local school district levy, even if it's a local board's decision, is that the legislature finds itself in the business of managing that overall property tax bill. And whether that's a good role for the legislature or not, I'd let the members speak to, but that's the reason we track school levies so carefully, even if it's a board decision.
Representative Hertoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I heard your answer correctly, there seems to be an intrinsic built-in system to encourage people to levy at the local level so they receive a subsubsidy.
Mr.
Strom.
Representative, I don't think I'd describe it that way. What I would say is that the legislature has a very strong view on what the overall level of property taxes ought to be. And so, for example, in the school area, it's not just about providing aid instead of the levy. It's also about telling school boards you're limited on your levy. For example, Representative Ansel asked about the Safe Schools levy. That's an area where the legislature has said, well, there's some reasons for you to levy here, but we're going to limit that. You've got a total of $30 per pupil that you can levy for that.
Representative Hertoff.
Thank you. Thank you for your very expedient articulation of those issues. You seem to be up to speed on all of that.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if Mr. Strom would comment on the other post-employment benefits. What initiated that discussion and change? Was it not a change in federal accounting requirements?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reinhart, there were some changes in how the federal accounting standards, which is referred to as GASB, the standards that apply to school districts, how they counted those benefits. And that was essentially going to reduce, because of the way that those changes were being accounted for, that would reduce some current year budgets for school districts across the nation. In my opinion, it was really a separate decision at the state level to decide whether or not to put additional levy authority for units of government into that category. And in 2008, when the tax committee passed out that bill, originally that didn't even come to the education committee. It was thought at the time that cities and counties would be the ones more likely to avail themselves of that. But turned out that school districts very quickly said, hey, this is going to work great for us. So I'm not sure that I'd say it was a direct response to the change in the accounting in the GASB standards. It certainly is all interrelated. There were two reports in the years prior to that change, one from the legislative auditor and one from the state auditor, both dealing with other post-employment benefits, and I think those were resting on legislators' minds as well at the time.
We'll take one more question, then we'll move on. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this will be a quick one, I promise. What exactly is tree growth?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, you'll be glad to know that the old name was stumpage.
Oh, my.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, what happened here with this was a change in the way we treated lands that that lumber had been, or that forests had been cut on. Was that there was a payment, essentially a style of payment that was like an in lieu of payment that went to local units of government, including school districts. And when that payment was changed, school districts realized, and there aren't too many that this applies to. You can see this is on line 43. It's a pretty small amount of money, less than $1 million a year, and you see it doesn't change much over time. But there were a few school districts where this was a significant portion of their budget, and so when the change in how that in lieu of payment was handled, essentially what happened is the legislature said, okay, we'll convert that actually to a levy for you for the same amount of revenue so that your districts aren't out the revenue because of the change in the way we're treating the stumpage. And the name became the tree growth because nobody could stand to look at the word stumpage on the spreadsheet. But this is another one. We'd be happy to give you a little spreadsheet that shows you the few districts that have this levy.
And Representative Woodard, I think you and I would agree that this line item probably has nothing to do with student growth and achievement. Might not be real data-driven, this line.
Yet another bipartisan Woodard. Approach.
Yes, thank you very much. Ms. Johnson, okay, Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, if there aren't any other questions about the levy tracking spreadsheet, I'm going to switch gears a little bit and start talking about the overall context of how K-12 finance fits within the overall state budget. And I believe Tim's going to bring up the PowerPoint here. It starts with, it's titled Minnesota K-12 Education Finance System Context and Overview. So I'll just give you a quick roadmap. There's a summary page that includes what we'll be covering. I'm going to discuss the state budget in the context of schools, and then I'm going to turn it over to Tim, who will talk about the mechanics of how the school property tax system works briefly. He'll talk about school enrollment trends and how that has been changing by region and size of district, and then finally talk about the other components of school finance, like categoricals and general education revenue. All right, so where does the money from the general fund come from? For the current fiscal year 13, the state has collected about $19.6 billion in revenue, and the primary sources have been traditionally the individual income tax at about 43% of overall revenues and sales tax at about 25. So those two pieces alone make up the biggest components of funds that come into the state for general ed, and that's where how schools are funded. So that's why we're focused in on the general fund. If you take a look at the next slide, where the money goes, it shouldn't be much of a surprise to you that for the current fiscal year that state general ed spending goes 46% to K-12 education, just about half of all general fund dollars, and the other largest share being health and human services at about 29%. As Tim referenced, the intergovernmental aids at 7%, higher education at 7%, that's kind of where the other major components are. So you do have a big task ahead of you in determining or setting the agenda for how K-12 funds will be allocated in this next budget cycle. If we move on to the next slide, we'll look at where the money is coming from that we're projecting for fiscal year 14. The state is projected to collect about $18.6 billion in revenues, and this time the individual income tax is taking up 46%. In fiscal 13, it was 43%, so the proportion that is being driven by or funds coming from the individual income tax is increasing slightly, and the portion from sales tax in 13 was 25% and has gone up to 27 or is going to 27%, so the slight change in the primary source of revenue there. So.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mariani?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm getting old, so it's hard for me to see these, but can you repeat the quick number on the individual income tax change?
Oh, sure. Ms. In Johnson. Fiscal 13, the current biennium, it was 43% for individual income tax, and now it's gone up to 46%. Or that's what's projected. For sales tax in 13 was 25%, and now it's going to 27%.
Mr. Straub.
If I could just add, part of this is because if you look at the fund balance on those two graphs, there's less fund balance coming in as a resource for fiscal year 14 than there was in fiscal year 13. So those jumps seem like quite a few percentage points, but a lot of that's explained because there's a smaller fund balance portion of the pie.
Oh, good point. Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Mr.
You okay? All right. Representative Bernardi?
Mr. Chair, just briefly, I do use these documents, and they're very helpful. Is there any way that some of us could have the larger print version? Because
wait.
I can't see it up really there very well.
Representative Bernardi, that will we will have that for the next
thing.
Yes, we will. So, yeah. Very good.
Mr. Chair and members, yeah. We will add that to the list of things we'll provide.
Very good.
Yeah.
Representative Woodard, and then...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, is this the same presentation, though, that's on the committee website, correct? Okay, so it can be found on the committee
correct.
Website.
Mr. Chair.
So those of you with computers.
Yeah, this is a general overview. You may have heard it. If you're a newer member, you may have heard it at the orientation. It's presented in several different forums, but we just thought it's helpful to give a context for overall how it fits in with school funding.
And as Representative Woodard mentioned, it is on the Education Finance website. It's been... And uploaded there.
And
so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, one other thing is sometimes the Ways and Means Committee treats fund balance differently than we do in this committee as a resource. Sometimes they exclude that as a resource. So you may see that the percentages look a little bit different. It'll be the exact same underlying data, but fund balance in or fund balance out can be an issue sometimes when comparing how we look at things compared to Ways and Means.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Ms. Johnson. Where are the revenues from our school trust lands? Is that on the pie here?
Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I don't believe that they are included in that. Is that
Mr. Straub.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, yes, the permanent school fund revenue is actually a separate fund from the state general fund, so it's going to show up, however, when you look to the when you look on the appropriations tracking sheet, you'll see a permanent school fund line there, either within or without general education in the detail. For those members new to this area, the state has a permanent school fund, primarily from the lands given to the state by the federal government. The resources in that fund are primarily mining, the results of mining lease over time. There's also some small amounts, relatively smaller amounts from leases of state land, and then logging is another portion of that. Those go into a fund. I think the balance is about $700 million or thereabouts, between $700 and $800 million right now. And each year the interest earnings on that fund are paid out to school districts. And for fiscal year 13, the year we're in now, I think we expect that to be about $28 per pupil or thereabouts of the of additional revenue to school districts from that fund. And again, that's an area where we could put a printout in the packet if members wanted to see.
Representative McDonald?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So is what sheet do you say that it's underlined? What number is that?
Mr. Chair, before you get too heavy into looking for it, it's actually not on there yet. I will be adding that to it. I had a discussion with... my director about that. And we'll
Representative McDonald.
And then being new to the thank you. Being new to the board and trying to go get from health and human services to education, you'll bear with me as I continue to educate myself, so thank you. Has there been any discussion in the years in these very tight budgets with school districts to take that $708 million that is in the bank collecting interest, and rather than paying out the interest to our schools, which is, of course, a wise investment as well, but to actually use that to fund our schools in these very tough economic times?
Representative McDonald, I think we're getting to a policy question. We're going to stick with technical, so I'm not going to have staff answer that right now. So I think that's later on we can talk about all that.
Very good, Mr. Chair. I'll look forward to that discussion.
Very good. All right, Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, the final slide of the pie charts is where the money is projected to go for base for fiscal 14. And as you can see, 41% for K-12 and an increase in percent for health and human services. In 13, it was at 29, and now it's moved to 31%. One component that is increasing slightly, and it's kind of a distortion from the last biennium, is that there's some counteracting effects of the tobacco bonds and how those paid for the general fund debt service for that biennium. And also, as we move forward, the authorization of the stadium bonds will also increase the debt service portion that will be dedicated from general ed funds or general fund revenues.
And I will entertain no questions on those stadium questions. Please.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add one more comment. When we track things at the state level, we're tracking the appropriation level, not the aid entitlement. So also remember that when you look at that fiscal year 13 spending for K-12 education, because of the repayment of the shift, of the $1.3 billion of the shift or thereabouts, that appropriation for fiscal year 13 is going to be much higher than the fiscal year 14 appropriation. So that also explains why the size on the where the money's going, where it's being spent, why the size of the pie chunks change, why the slices change, because we're looking at appropriations here, the actual amount the state's appropriating, not an aid entitlement amount. So it's helpful from a state tracking point of view, but it may not tell you much. If you compared 13 and 14 and said, gee, the state's done something different to schools, really doesn't tell you much about school revenue. It tells you about the outflow from the state because of the shift in those 2 years.
Okay. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not asking that it be addressed now here, but it might be good to have a reference distributed to the committee, especially the new members or freshmen, that sort of goes over the shift, you know, fairly complex, and so they realize that all of this money showing up isn't going to be like a huge windfall. It's just paid earlier, and you know, so if there would be at some point that education distributed to the members.
Okay, thank you, Representative Quam. And there was a handout also yesterday or 2 days ago. Yeah, 2 days ago, where we did, there was a handout on the shift, so take a look at that also, but we can come back to that. Also, we certainly will, as a committee, do that. Representative Hertaus.
Yes, Mr. Chair. If we're at the conclusion of this presentation, I have a question.
We've got a ways to go, Representative Hertaus.
Okay. I'll save it till
we have you on the list. And Representative Witter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will keep it quick. Mr. Strom, do you know historically, you know, we're looking at a 40 to 43% share of the state budget going to K-12. Do you know what that looks like historically over the last 10 years? Do we have documents on that?
Mr. Chair, Strom? Representative Witter, yes, we can bring you documents on that. If you call back to the levy tracking sheet, remember that between fiscal years 2002 and 2003, about $1 billion of school levy was eliminated for $1 billion more of state aid. So starting in that year, the pie portion became somewhat bigger for K-12 education. And has stayed at that relatively larger level. I don't want to get us too far off track. We can certainly get you historical data, but two things to point out about this. In the time that I've been at the legislature as a staff person here, that share for higher education and the share for health and human services are the two that have changed the most. Back in 1987, when I started with the K-12 committee, the higher ed share was more than 15%, and the human services share was under 25% then. So that's been the share that's growing, and higher ed has been the share that's fallen the most over the last 30 years.
Ms. Johnson.
All right. So the next section, because schools are funded with a combination of state aids and local property taxes, it's helpful to look at the overall state and local tax revenue history, and this kind of gets to some of the discussion we had just a bit ago. As you can see, in the 50s and 60s, the state had a very significant reliance on local property tax. Yep. Okay, so very significant reliance on property tax. 53%. At 36% were other taxes, or these are the sin taxes, tobacco, cigarette type of things that played a pretty significant role. And to a lesser extent, the income tax and the sales tax, which came online in 1967. So you can see how the makeup of it was previous and where we're at today. And as you can see, there's that line of demarcation where it talks about the Minnesota Miracle, and that's where we significantly changed the way we funded schools to take significant pressure off of the local property tax as the primary means of funding schools. So as a trade-off for that, the income tax and the sales tax were the state components that increased to offset that other increase. It's interesting to note, too, the sin taxes, or the other taxes, went from 36% for being the second highest proportion of state and local revenues down to 17%, so it's trailed off significantly. And one final thing to note is that for the income and sales tax, these taxes are the ones that the state aid share is most heavily relied upon for school funding, and these are the two most volatile taxes that are most susceptible to fluctuations in the economy and different economic conditions. So the last couple of years, it's been quite a volatile tax. So, as I touched on last week, or I guess it was Tuesday, how are state aids trending over time? And we talked about how the percentage of aid and levy has been pretty consistent over time through the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. In the late 90s, and then with the property tax overhaul that Tim has referenced a couple of times here, that with that change, the state portion of funding went up to as almost a 90%, and over time it has declined a bit to around 77%, and I believe the next slide just has a graphical representation of that, so you can see in the late 90s, the increase, the peak in 2001-ish, and the decline or to where we're at today. So from there, I'm going to hand it over to Tim, and he's going to walk you through
Mr. Straub. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll spend, I know you want to finish at 9:45, and we want to look at the printouts for a few minutes, so we'll try and finish up pretty quick here. As well as state aids, you've also got property taxes under the domain of this committee, and so it's helpful for you to remember some of the terminology that we use in Minnesota to describe our property tax system. A couple things to talk about. We have two major tax bases we use. We have one that's a variant of taxable market value, and the other we call taxable tax capacity, or net tax capacity. Taxable market value is simply, if you were to look at the value of the property, of each piece of property, regardless of its type in an area, and add it all together, that's essentially the taxable market value. We make a small reduction for homes for the market value exclusion. But essentially, if you were to see a house for $50,000, an apartment building for $200,000, a business for $2 million, add those all together, that means the taxable market value of a school district. To get to the tax capacity, or net tax capacity, which is the main measure we use for most school district levies, we take that market value and we multiply it by a legislatively set class rate. And the class rates are the legislature's way of determining the ratios of the various types of property classes. So, for example, a residential homestead property, people's homes, have a class rate on the first $500,000 of value of 1%. Ag lands have a class rate, excluding the house, garage, and 1 acre, have a class rate on the first $1.29 million of lands of 0.55, whereas most commercial industrial property is over the $150,000, so the amount over that has a class rate of 2%. And then seasonal rec property, which is the cabins, mirrors the class rates for homestead property. These class rates are set by the legislature. The tax committee fights about them all the time, but the results of their fighting affect what happens to the distribution of school levies. So even if this committee does nothing with school levies, if the tax committee changes any of those ratios for the class rates, it will affect how school taxes are distributed both among districts and among property types within the district. A couple other terms for you to know about. We take the net tax capacity of the school district, and then we adjust that before we compute an equalized aid and levy. And we use something called the sales ratio to make that adjustment. And what the sales ratio is the Department of Revenue actually looks at the sale price of property that sells and compares it to where the assessor carried that property. And if the assessor is uniformly under-assessing property or over-assessing it, the sales ratio will adjust for that. Sales ratios trend in times like now where there aren't radical changes in the prices of homes toward one. If home values start increasing fairly quickly, again, you'll see sales ratios of 0.8 and 0.9, et cetera. And the way we use that sales ratio is we take the net tax capacity, that is the tax base we use for most levies. We've applied those class rates for the market value to get that. And then we divide it by the sales ratio. And the idea is that gives us a fair measure of tax base from district to district. The second tax base we use, so our net tax capacity on the levy worksheet that Ms. Johnson gave you, most of those levies, all but a few of them, the operating referendum being the biggest, are calculated on net tax capacity. But the operating referendum and two other little levies are calculated on referendum market value. And that's the taxable market value for the property in each district. So there's no class rates involved. But then there's two categories of property that are entirely excluded. Those are ag lands and seasonal rec. So, in other words, cabins and farmland don't pay for the operating referendum. On almost all the other school levies, they do. But when you pass an operating referendum in a local school district, the ag lands and the seasonal rec property is excluded. It's important to keep in mind that we've got these two tax bases. Any system that tries to simplify things needs to be careful that they keep the balance between these two levies about the same, or there'll be some shifting. When we hear about the Department of Education school funding work group and their proposal, part of the trick that they were trying to look at is how not to get shifting if you combine some levy categories, and part of that is because we have these two separate tax bases for schools. I'll just skip through the next pretty quick here. Property taxes were a major part of our funding system and still are. They're about a quarter of the total funding for most schools now, but their share has certainly decreased, as Ms. Johnson said, since the Minnesota Miracle in 1971. When you look at where that property tax goes by type of government, you can see for taxes payable in 2012, which goes with the current school year, the taxpayers in the state paid $8.38 billion of property tax to local units of government and to the state, and you can see the relative shares here. School districts are on the left at 27% of the total. Counties are the largest share of the property tax at 31%. Cities are 22%, plus the TIF districts are another 3%. So that's about 25% for that category. And then 4% are in special districts. And then commercial industrial property and seasonal rec property both pay a tax into the state, a statewide property tax that comes into the state general coffers. And that's about 10% of the total property tax paid. So in terms of recipients, schools get about 27% of the total property tax paid by taxpayers. One thing I wanted to show you with this chart is the difference between taxable market value and the taxes paid by property type. And this is largely the result of the class rates. You can see on the left here is taxable market value. Add up the value of all our homes and businesses and farms in Minnesota, and it totals $552 billion. And residential homestead property, the homes, are 51% of the total. The ag lands are a full 18% of the total, and you can see the other shares on the pie there. When we apply the class rates to determine who's going to pay that property tax, though, you can see the legislature's got a deliberate policy of having farmlands pay less, so they go from 18% of the total tax base on taxable market value to 8% of the taxes paid. Homeowners get a break compared to their market value as well. They're paying 43% of the total compared to the 51% of total value they've got. And on the other hand, commercial industrial, the business property in the state, makes up 15% of the tax base but pays 35% of the property taxes in the state. And this is in large part why the tax committee spends so much time looking at the property tax system and class rates. Any adjustment in those rates, essentially adjustment in a ratio, means that one group of taxpayers is going to pay more and the other less if those class rates are moved around. So, Mr. Chair, when we think about our property taxes in this state, the total about $8.3 billion for the current year, and about 27% of that's going to the schools. We've got another section in here on counting students, but I think we'll skip over that and go to the printouts now. That may be the best way to proceed given the limited time.
Okay. Representative Hertas, do you have a question now?
I was just wondering if it's possible to put up that photo you had of the state capitol.
Oh, sure. Put that back in here. I was, When I was loading the other document, I wanted to make sure.
Representative Hertaus, I'm going to give you a little leeway here, but.
Well, I just wanted to let Representative Woodard know that there's another footnote to tree growth or stumpage. And if you look at those trees on the Capitol there, a company that I own donated those trees, and with the help of the Osceola School District and third graders planted those trees back in 1980.
No levy.
Thank you very much. Without levy. Very good. That is a nice picture. Very nice picture. All right, Mr. Strump.
Okay, Mr. Chair. We'll
and where are we at right now? What documents are we looking at?
We're going to switch to the general education printouts, and you've got two in your packet, and I want to make sure that's what I load up so that you don't
And so, members, it looks like this.
So you've got two printouts, one sideways. That's the one we're going to look at first, the one that's landscaped that says baseline general education revenue for fiscal year 14. And then the second printout we'll look at that has the same kind of information on it, but more summarized with some extra columns, is labeled Gen Ed components, percent of students eligible at the top. So those are the two printouts that we're going to work on here. And let's see if I can, give me 2 seconds here, and I'll see if I can load this up in a way that... it's okay on the screen.
For and here. While Mr. Strom is doing that, I would like to remind members that when we have certain bills up, like as the year goes on, we'll take them, try to do them kind of in categories. And what I have talked to Ms. Johnson and Mr. Strom about is then before we cover that area, they'll give a little synopsis again of that area. So even though we're kind of doing a general overview, if it's something on safe school levies, we would have a short overview on safe school levies before we hear the bill. So there, we'll come back to that too. So if, you know, this is kind of quick, there's an awful lot, but as we cover bills during the year, we'll also come back and review again also, if that would be okay with the members.
Okay,
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, just a couple general rules or general thoughts about how we do printouts in this committee. And Ms. Johnson and I are happy to send the spreadsheets to folks for purposes of posting things to the website. I think PDFs are preferred for accessibility reasons, so we often send out a PDF, but we're always happy to send members or staff spreadsheets if they'd rather look at a spreadsheet. The way that school districts are organized in Minnesota, we have about 336 school districts and about 150 charter schools. And we like to use sort of a similar layout all year so that as things get busier and busier, we can toss data together onto the same spreadsheets without too much trouble. We usually list school districts in numerical order instead of alphabetical order. We're happy to sort them however folks want, but the reason we do that is when school district numbers were assigned, they were originally assigned by county. If you ordered the counties in alphabetical order and then gave a school district number to starting with the first two digits of that county, so for instance, Hennepin County is the 27th county. All the Hennepin County school districts basically have 270, 271, 272 as their district numbers. It puts like districts in the same county next to each other. So the district number order actually kind of helps in that regard. But again, we're happy to sort them. If members would rather see information in districts alphabetically, we can certainly do that. Usually our main problem when we're looking at a spreadsheet is there's way too much information that members are going to want to see, and how do we put that in a form that's big enough to see and shows enough columns to make sense but still fits on a piece of paper. So we're often showing things on a per pupil basis because that'll save us a lot of space on the paper if we don't show totals but show a per pupil amount of revenue. So most spreadsheets you're going to see are going to show a dollar amount per pupil, and they're going to use some sort of pupil count on them. On the spreadsheet that's in front of you, that very first column of data is the adjusted marginal cost pupil units for fiscal year 14. That's the count of students. Representative Hertaus asked earlier about how many pupils we had for funding purposes. We've got 962,000 for this year. That's pretty close to a million, so when we use that, every dollar on the formula costs $1 million. That'll get us pretty close in the ballpark there as a rule of thumb. So as you look down that column, you can see the relative size of each of the school districts. You can see that the Aiken School District's got 1,395 funding pupil units. The Minneapolis School District, 38,498. The Anoka School District, which is number 11, 42,976. So you can see how those pupil counts change and see that there's a lot of variation. We've got some very, very small school districts in Minnesota and a few very large school districts as well. And then as we read across the printout, you're going to see each of the categories of general education revenue. So for the line on the printout that showed the general education levy and the line on the printout or on the spreadsheet that showed the appropriation, they're based on these categories of revenue that go into that calculation. And that first one there, basic revenue, is the same. That's the one thing that's the same for every district in the state. Each district for fiscal year 14 under the baseline scenario will get $5,224 per pupil. And again, if you've got questions about how we calculate each part of these formulas, Ms. Johnson's guidebook and the guidebook I put together have details about how to go about calculating these formulas, how they've changed over time, and that kind of thing. But the basic revenue shows up there. You can see for Aiken, $5,224 of basic revenue. The next category of general education revenue is called extended day revenue. This is money for summer school and for extended school years, school day programs. Averages about $76 per kid. Again, using our rule of thumb of about $1 million per kid, that's about $76 million statewide. And you can see that varies fairly substantially. Some districts have very extensive extended day programs, others not so much. And you can look up and down that list and see the amount that districts get in that category of revenue. The next category, as we're going to the right, is compensatory revenue. And this is the one that you'll probably spend the most time talking about, as it tends to be the most controversial part of the general education formula. Again, $511 is the average per pupil, so we're spending about $500 million statewide per year on compensatory revenue. And it's a concentration formula, which means the more free and reduced lunch kids a district has, and it's calculated at the site level, the greater amount of money per free and reduced lunch child that the district receives. And you can look up and down that list and see that the districts, some districts are over $2,000 per pupil, others are under $100 per pupil, depending on the demographics of the students they're serving. Because of that concentration element of it, there's a lot of discussion about whether the compensatory formula is set in the right way or not. We'll talk about that in a different different context and different day. The next category is limited English proficiency revenue. Again, we have to sort of abbreviate all these headings to fit them on a spreadsheet. Averages about $42 per district, but you can see there's a lot of districts with zeros that don't get any money under the formula as they have relatively few non-English speaking students. Other districts with large non-English speaking populations get upwards of $150 per pupil in revenue in that category. The next category of revenue was created 2 years ago, and it's called small schools revenue. A district with fewer than 1,000 students in total is eligible for this revenue, and the smaller the district, the greater per pupil this amount of revenue gets to be. And you can look up and down the list there, $17 million statewide on that, and you can see there's some districts that it's more than $450 million, or $450. Many districts are at zero because if a district's more than 1,000 pupils, they don't qualify for revenue under that category. Then the next category, operating sparsity revenue, is intended for those districts that are geographically isolated. There's about 90 districts in the state that are both small and a long distance from the next nearest school. Statewide, that's about $26 million, $25 million thereabouts. And you can see that the amounts vary pretty substantially there as you go up and down the list. You'll see a few of the very sparse districts are well over $1,000 in operating sparsity revenue. Most districts get zero, but some get a relatively small amount. Again, it depends on the district and how far it is to the next nearest school. Transportation sparsity revenue is also based on the district's sparsity count, basically density of kids per square mile. In 1997, the legislature replaced our categorical transportation funding formula and put more money on the formula and then created transportation sparsity revenue. You can see there's a fair amount of variation there as well. Many districts revenue. You can see there's a fair amount of variation there as well. Many districts are concerned that the transportation sparsity revenue comes nowhere near to the cost of their transportation services. Then, as Representative Greenhagen was asking earlier, the operating capital revenue is listed, about $206 million statewide, $206 per pupil. And you can see there's not a whole lot of variation there. There's a building age index built into that. So if you're under $200 per pupil, you've got relatively new buildings. If you're over $200 per pupil, you've got relatively older buildings. That's money that in the current year is free to be transferred however the district wants, but in general is required to be set aside and reserved for technology or small facility upkeep needs. The next category of revenue is equity revenue, averages about $97 per pupil, and this revenue is designed to help low-revenue districts. There's four different parts of the formula. We won't go into the details about those right now, but the result is this amount of revenue also varies quite a bit. The districts that get the most revenue under this are districts like Aiken that have very little referendum because it takes into account the amount of operating referendum you've got. However, you're worse off with no referendum than just a very small amount of referendum. So when we get to the referendum column, which is fourth from the end, you can see that Aiken has about 10 cents of referendum authority per kid. And the reason they do that is that leverages that $206 per pupil of equity revenue. The next category of revenue is all the same. Each district gets $12 per pupil that they've got to reserve for gifted and talented programs. And then there's a category of revenue called transition revenue, and this is a hold harmless or a grandfather from previous changes to the school finance system. And when districts were losers under the changes, often the way to do it, if someone proposed a new system of funding or a new set of categories in order to make it palatable for others, their revenue was grandfathered in. And this transition revenue has been ongoing. It really hasn't been added to in the last 10 years now, but it carries some components that go back 25 years. And you can see the amount varies by district. Average is about $31. Then the next category is actually a reduction to general education revenue. There were four different times mainly in the 90s when the legislature adjusted the teacher PERA member contribution rates for the retirement fund. Two of those adjustments were up and two of those adjustments were down. And the net result of that was what happened is the legislature said to school districts, hey, we're giving you a smaller rate to contribute to teacher retirement, so we're going to take away a little money so that you're held harmless, but you're no better off because of us lowering your contribution rate. So some of those were lowering the rates. A couple of the others were correcting the rates. There was no adjustment made when the big rate increases were passed a few years back. But you can see those amounts vary pretty substantially by district. If nothing happens with those adjustments come 2020, they're scheduled to expire. But in the meantime, you can see the amount of the reduction. Then the next category, options adjustments, is three different sets of adjustments, relatively small, that have to do with open enrolling students and students going to the Faribault Academies and things. We can talk about those more later, but relatively small adjustments for most school districts under that category. Then the fourth to last category here is the operating referendum revenue for each district. $920 per pupil is the average. You can see there's a lot of districts below average and a lot of districts above average. Those districts that have a dollar or some portion of a dollar are districts like Aiken that are essentially using a little bit of referendum as a way to leverage the equity revenue formula, but you can look up and down that list. Referendum revenue is capped. We'll talk about that more in detail. If you're eligible for sparsity revenue, for those 90 districts, they're outside of that cap. But for the other districts, they're subject to a series of caps on the overall amount that their voters are allowed to approve.
Well, thank you.
The next column, the third to last, is Q-code revenue. This is the teacher pay and performance pay revenue, alternative compensation, it's sometimes called, averages about $90 per pupil. You'll see that it's very heavily concentrated in the metro area. Many of the metro districts have chosen to join the program. Most of the districts in greater Minnesota have not. So those are the categories of general education revenue, and when you add those all the way across the page, you get to the second to last column of total general education revenue. And the average district in the state then gets $7,317 per pupil unit. And you can look up and down the list and see that some are less than that and some are greater than that. And you can look back at the columns to see where those changes are and why some are higher and why some are lower. And then that last column just takes any district that shows up with a positive pupil count and ranks them from most revenue to least. And you can see, for example, then that Aiken is a very low revenue district. They're 345th out of about 485 almost 500 districts and charter schools. Minneapolis is toward the high end at 26th in revenue, and you can look up and down the list there and see where your districts are in comparison to that state total. So this is the general way we'll lay out a printout about baseline information. We'll often then be asked to take this and compare it. Maybe we'll compare baseline general education revenue to the governor's recommendation, or maybe we'll compare it to other factors. So, Mr. Chair, if there are questions on the printout, we may want to stop there. I know we'll spend more time on general education a little later this year, but if there are questions about how the printout's organized or how these columns are adding or something like that, I'd be happy to address those.
Thank you. Representative Seltzer.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question on the QComp revenue. I believe that part of QComp is local levy and part is state aid. Is that reflected here, and could you give the percentages if it is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Seltzer, that's a very good question. What's showing on this printout is revenue. So this is the sum of aid and levy in each of these categories, and most of the general education program is aid. Let me just go through these categories and tell you which ones are not all aid. Basic revenue all the way through transportation sparsity revenue, those categories are all aid currently. Operating capital is an equalized aid and levy, so what you're seeing here is the sum of the aid and the levy in that program. It's equalized at a pretty high level, so most districts will get some equalization aid under the operating capital category. Equity revenue is on the referendum market value tax base and is more heavily levy than aid. Gifted and talented is all aid. Transition revenue is a mix of levy and aid, and again, more heavy on the levy. The adjustments are aid adjustments. And then the referendum revenue, that $920 per pupil of referendum revenue. Referendum revenue is a mix of aid and levy. About a fifth of it on average is aid, but for most metro districts, their referendum's entirely levy. And then on the QComp program, the way that program works is essentially districts eligible for $169 per pupil of aid. And then the difference between there and $260 is an equalized aid and levy. And so for most of the metro districts, that portion of it is going to be levy. So about 90 of the 260 is levy in the QComp category for metro districts. For districts with low tax base, that's an equalized aid and levy on that $90 portion. So those are the levy shares of these. We tend to look at revenue in this committee as we're managing both the aids and levies. On some programs, we can split that out pretty easily for you. So, for instance, if someone wanted to see equity revenue by aid and levy, we're happy to do that. Again, it's sort of extra columns. But that's a real good question, that most of what you're going to see in here are going to be revenue printouts, and we can sure separate out aid and levy on those if folks are interested.
Thank you very much. Before we do any more questions, Mr. Strom, are you going to go over this?
Yes.
Just the headings. Let's just go over the headings, because I know members are going to have lots of materials to look at over the weekend, so they at least know to do this. Spend just a couple minutes, and we'll spend the rest of the time with questions.
That sounds good.
Mr. Chair, just kind of cover the headlines.
Members, the second printout says general ed components at the top of it, and it's organized portrait style. And this was Representative Reinhardt at the end of the last hearing said, is there any way to put other information on printouts besides just the numbers? And this I'm not intending to claim that there's any relationships here, but two of the things that the committee talked about the other day were percentage of children in poverty and percentage students of color. So I thought, well, gee, we'll just take those factors in general education revenue that vary a lot, which are things like compensatory and operating sparsity and referendum, look at those as a percent of the state average, and then look at general ed as a percent of the state average. And then put on these two other factors, look at poverty as a percent of state average and students of color as a percent of state average, and just give you a little information about how that might line up. So, for example, look across at Aiken there. On their general ed revenue, they're at 91% of the state average amount of general education. In terms of poverty, their poverty rate, where 46% of the kids in the Aiken School District qualify for free or reduced price meals, puts them at 123% of the state average. And then on their students of color, they're about 4% compared to the state average of about 26%. So they're at 16% of the state average in that category. So this is just an example of how we can write some other data onto a spreadsheet if folks are interested. Some variables are easy to write on. Others are very problematic to even think about conceptually how to put on a spreadsheet. But we're happy to show percentages or changes or other things as opposed to just raw numbers. So the purpose of this spreadsheet, Mr. Chair, was simply to say, here's two other things the committee had talked about. Here's some percentages. Percentage of state average may not be a very meaningful measure at all for any of these things, but it's just an example of how you can, one way that you could evaluate how does a level of compensatory of $1,400 compared to a level of $500.
Very good. Well, let's go back to questions, and that's how we're going to finish the day. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We on this side of the table, just a curiosity, we're wondering why Aiken and Minneapolis bear the same school district number.
Yeah, that is a good question.
Mr. Chair, some things are done simply to drive me crazy. We have three main kinds of, and you can imagine with data why it's just absolutely terrible to have two school districts with the same number. We have three kinds of school districts in Minnesota. Nearly all the districts are independent school districts. We have two special school districts, which are Minneapolis and South St. Paul. And Minneapolis is special school district number one. Aiken is independent school district one. And then we have two school districts that are common school districts. And these districts, Franconia and Princeburg, don't offer a K-12 program. There's some historical reasons why they exist. But this issue of having two districts labeled number one is really problematic.
Very good. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Strom, I'm going to go back to the school trust lands. Just curious, if it's $28 per student, that's $28 million. I'm just curious why it doesn't show up on our spreadsheet and as to a funding mechanism for our education.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, we can certainly put that on any spreadsheet that we want. These are the basic components of what we call general education revenue. And the way that permanent school fund works, it's sort of been outside of this type of spreadsheet. We can certainly build that on our common lookup table, which is another way we'll do a data piece for you. What that allows you to do is get a whole page of information about funding for your school district. And on there, it's easy for us to identify a line like permanent school fund. But on here, the only reason really it's not is it would have been yet another line to add to the spreadsheet.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Then what other mechanisms of funding is not on this sheet for our school district?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, there's all the categorical funding, things like special ed, which are large amounts of funding, and then all of the smaller aid and levy programs that we've got that Ms. Johnson went through on the two spreadsheets. Each of those line items. Each of the line items on there essentially is a separate program, and there's going to be some money for most school districts under each of those programs on there. So we've got 20 plus levy programs and 50 plus aid programs in the K-12 area. Most of them are relatively small. General ed is more than 80% of the total, which is why we tend to focus on it. But there are all these other small programs out there that are revenue for schools and school districts.
And Mr. Strom, I would ask you also to do a run where you've got general ed revenue, and then you have all the other kind of categorical too. That gives you even a little better picture on the per pupil funding.
Yeah, and Mr.
funding.
Chair, we can do some of those categories fairly easily. Others are kind of hard to do. We'll show you that maybe next time we can show you this lookup table. As we'll just print a page out for a sample district. We'll choose one of Representative McDonald's districts, and you can see the major categories of operating revenue that show up on that sheet.
Very good, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did note the chair's hint that we should be spending the weekend reading these. So I guess there goes my weekend. Very quick question. So I remember when we used to have transportation aid separate. Obviously, we don't have it anymore except for the sparsity component. So that's in the basic revenue. Can you tell us if we disaggregated that out at the point at which we made that change, what part of that $5,224 roughly would be transportation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, when we rolled that in, it was 4.85% of the formula allowance. So about $230 per pupil or thereabouts at the current formula allowance level.
Thank you.
Okay, we have time for one more question. Representative Radinovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strama, I was just wondering what your indicators on the general ed component spreadsheet these come from.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Strom. Very good question. The general education revenue is for fiscal year 14, so this is estimated for this coming school year, not the year we're in now, but next school year using November forecast data. And then to put the couple extra categories on this one, the that show the percent children in poverty and the percent students of color, we do not yet have the fall counts for free and reduced lunch, which should be available within the month. So this is the fall of 2011 free and reduced lunch counts. And then the percent students of color is from also from the fall of 11 count of students.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Strom, Ms. Johnson, thank you so much. Next Tuesday, we will start hearing from groups coming in with data-driven research or efforts and strategies to meet some of our goals. And we're going to be hearing from early childhood on Tuesday. Wednesday, a reminder of the joint meeting with the Senate regarding the governor's budget. So everyone, thanks for a great week. Have a great weekend, and we are adjourned.